Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. On today's program, we will discuss the political debate surrounding immigration and DACA, as well as how this issue has been framed in various media outlets. Our discussion will include an in-studio conversation with college student activists. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-hosts, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III and Amy Casey. And we are broadcasting from lovely Hayward, California. And today's a really interesting day. We've got a roundtable of people here, a ton of guests in studio. You're going to hear a lot of voices. And we at Project Censored are always happy to bring new voices, especially young voices, to our listeners. And today is kind of a big week for us. We are celebrating 1 year. It was a year ago today on Inauguration Day when Donald Trump was elected as president, that we started taking over half the shows. Our listeners remember that Mickey and Peter hosted the Project Censored Show for 6 years, and last year we took over half the shows each month, and we made it a year through Trump's presidency.
Woohoo!
Oh, nice. Yes. Also, a big announcement for our listeners. You can come out and meet us, and we want to meet you at the Project Censored Conference, which will be October 26th, 27th, 2018 at the College of Marin in the San Francisco Bay Area. Come on out and meet us. Get a chance to hang with us. We love to talk to our listeners. We'll even get Desiree out there. We'll get the whole crew together. So come on out to the Project Censored Conference. Mark your calendars, October 26th, 27th, 2018. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
This is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. On today's program, we will discuss immigration policy and higher education.
All right. Thank you very much, Amy. Now, Alexandra Archuleta is here to tell us more about how you can get in contact with Project Censored Show and its contributors.
I'm Alexandra Archuleta with the Media Freedom Foundation. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to www.projectcensored.org, where you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. You can also rate and like us on iTunes. If you would like to reach the show or have us discuss something on the air, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Your feedback can also be directed to Twitter, to Nolan, which is at Nolan_Higdon, or Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks, or to Desiree at Des_Blacktivist.
All right. Thank you very much, Alexandra. Nice to have you in studio. By the way, Twitter. I've been thinking about this. We all use Twitter here at the show, and we get contacted, and it's nice to talk to listeners. But the power of Trump's Twitter account has become, like, incredible. And the media's got this, like, lazy corporate media, I should say, has this lazy methodology now of just following whatever Trump tweets, and that's their news story for the day. It basically is like Trump sends in basically his press briefings. Have you noticed this, Nick?
Yes, I have. Policy has been directed through Twitter consistently. But you've heard me say before on the show that, you know, we are now living in a space of bread and circuses. You have open corruption. It's sort of like the fall of Rome. You have open corruption in your face. You have a lazy news media. Interestingly enough, you have things like the recent film The Post, which gives viewers and the public a sense of a responsible news media that pursued fact-based journalism. And you have to contrast that with the media, the corporate media that we have right now following tweets, which are not a part of fact-based news.
Yeah, and what sort of stuns me about it, and I know this is somewhat preaching to the choir, but The corporate press covers Trump, but what credibility does he have? So they make these long lists where they say, here's all the times Trump has lied or spread falsehoods. And so they admit they know that, but then they still cover what he says. Like, why cover what he says if you've already know he has no credibility?
Well, see, the thing is that, you know, this is reality TV. What they have done, what the Trump administration has effectively done, is it's turned politics into reality TV. And at the end of the day, I think 100 years from now, we're going to look back on this and we're going to look at this as the advent of reality politics. I think that's what we're living through. So they follow the nonsense the same way that you would a show. If you think back to, for example, a couple of us are old enough to remember when MTV's Real World began, right? Well, how did you set up that show? You set it up with putting people in a space in which you had these kind of conflicting personalities. You knew people wouldn't get along. They would start fights. There would be a lot of drama. There would be a lot of back-talking. Well, what do you have with the Trump administration and the tweets? The same thing, right? So what does the president have to say about Mitch McConnell today? Let's get into that drama. This is no different than, say, in the Real World, where you'd bring one House member into the special room and then they would talk badly about another one. And we'd wait till next week to follow and see what the comeback was from the other person in the House. We're doing the same thing here, right? What is Steve Bannon going to say next, right? Maybe we should follow Steve Bannon's tweets, too. You know, how many Twitter feeds should we follow? Maybe that's really the way we should do politics in general. We should just follow everybody's Twitter feed, right?
Before the show started today, you were talking about how we need more toilet sounds. I think every time we mention Steve Bannon, we should have a toilet sound going.
Flushing sound, yeah. Absolutely.
He does look like he belongs in a toilet.
Yeah. Actually, I think every time we mention Donald Trump's tweets, we should have a sound. We should mention the tweet and then flush it.
I also liked how you started that out saying that you think humans are still going to be alive in 100 years. Oh, that was good.
Well, yes, I'm optimistic in that sense. I do believe that we are doing some serious damage to our politics and to any notion of what constitutes a representative democracy. And frankly, I'm worried about the younger generation that's looking at this, that's looking at these tweets, that's looking at this language that's being used at the highest level, and that's looking at the process that we're going through, the political processes. I know when I came up as a kid, just sort of dating myself here, the first political thing that I ever became aware of was Watergate. So I was, 7 years old when Watergate was happening, and I had I lived in a very political household. Many black households are extremely political. You talk politics all the time over dinner. But my perception of the presidency was forever going to be formed by Nixon. Not necessarily Kennedy, although you'd look back to that and read about that historically. I became aware of presidential politics through Nixon. My expectations, therefore, through the course of my life have been extremely low for who occupies that office. And I wonder for somebody who's 7 right now, looking at politics, looking at tweets, looking at negative comments made about people of color who live in countries abroad where they're struggling, and by the way, struggling because of U.S. policy. I wonder what these young people are thinking about our politics, our presidency, and what they'll grow to expect when they become adults.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that part up too, because you've got these government shutdown discussions, and we've done reviews of government shutdowns. Since the government's only started shutting down because it couldn't pass a budget starting in the 1970s, and most of those fights have been over abortion spending. And you talk about people growing up in this day and age, and this is the image of the presidency. There was a couple polls that came out this month that showed that the image of the United States as a leader is dropping dramatically.
Yes, 18 points down from the last year of the Obama administration.
And Americans are sort of stunned, but this isn't a Trump trend. This has been a trend for the last 30 or 40 years. And I think you look at things like not being able to fund your own government.
Correct.
As these are sort of signs of that Roman Empire narrative you were talking about earlier, which is the decline happens slowly over time. It's not under one president in 1 year. And you can sort of step back and I think see America going down that path.
Right. And we have specifically ceded world leadership to Germany. And even China is thought of globally in better terms than we are. We have simply abdicated world leadership. And I think we've abdicated a lot of things. We've abdicated since Trump getting sworn in January of last year, we have abdicated moral leadership, moral authority in that office. This notion that the president somehow has some kind of moral authority, that obviously we saw him abdicate clearly at Charlottesville. We also watched it during the King holiday, while the president was the first president in recent memory not to honor King Day as a day of service, but to decide to golf on that day. So that's gone. global leadership is gone as we've pulled out of things like the Paris Accord, for example, and now we're not the leader in climate change anymore. And as we've kind of reverted to Trump's version of a nativist, nationalist sensibility.
So, Nick, as you know, our listeners tune in to hear us to break down sort of the media narratives. And so I just saw what I'm calling media poison. It's a new segment I want to create. Mitch should give us some cool sound effect. We should get a cool media poison sound effect.
Was poison.
Poison. Let me tell y'all something.
It's also
they poison me.
Poison is very sweet.
The media that we have become
poison.
I saw that there are these narratives that are being created in the corporate press that I don't see really challenge. I see them constructing it, and I want to hear your opinion on this. But, you know, there's this S-hole comment that President Trump made, and I saw a couple of problems with the narrative the media constructed around it. One was they tried to focus on whether or not it was proper way to speak without really describing why there are racist implications to the way he used the term. And then the debate shifted to this discussion of merit-based immigration, not race-based immigration. But the merit base is racist.
Correct.
Okay. Can you kind of unpack that for our listeners? Because I think that the corporate media acts like they're two different things, and I see them as one and the same.
Well, see, if you don't historicize that term merit in American politics, most, I think – in terms of proximity of time, that term merit has been used quite a bit, or was used quite a bit, in the destruction of affirmative action, college admissions, right, and getting jobs through affirmative action, merit-based systems. And what merit-based systems have meant in that sort of discursive context is that we're not going to look at race or gender or sexual identity as things that might have contributed to someone not being able to get where they need to get, right, and being discriminated against systemically. But that what we're going to do is we're just strictly going to look at, through a merit-based system, the record. Now, when you think about a merit-based system or having a merit-based system, it means that you stop looking at the historical and social economic circumstances that people bring to the table. So it might be that if you have, say, in the case of college admissions, you have a 3-5 student here and a 2-5 student over there. Okay, if we simply look at the 3-5 and the 2-5, we're going with the 3-5, right? But if we were to look at the social circumstances surrounding the school in which that 3-5 student earned their high school diploma or whatever, and the school that the 2-5 student went to, and we looked at those resources, we see that there may be dramatic differences in terms of the resources that both of those people had access to. A merit-based system chooses not to look at that. In other words, a merit-based system chooses not to look at systemic oppression. It chooses to look only at numbers and results. Do you have a 3-5 or do you have a 2-5? Were you class valedictorian or not? But it can never speak to, and purposely doesn't speak to, the conditions that produce differences amongst individuals who are competing in the marketplace.
It's the racist colorblind narrative, right?
Exactly. It's the racist colorblind narrative. So now that word is being artfully placed within the context of immigration. What is merit-based immigration? Now, if you can intimate from some of what the president has talked about, particularly when he made his contrast between Haitian immigrants, African immigrants, and immigrants from Norway, he's talking about immigrants who come in already with a certain level of training, sophistication, education, etc. There are two problems with that. One is the race-blind color narrative, okay? And maybe a third problem with this, too, that I'll elaborate. The other one is that it is fundamentally racist to claim or imply, as he's doing, that people who come from, say, Haiti or El Salvador or wherever there are black or brown people, that those people are not bringing intellectual capability, that they don't have degrees, that they don't have some kind of training that's going to be valid. I think we really need to look substantively at how many immigrants from different countries are doing things like they're serving in our military, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they are coming with training and degrees. It's kind of like this American narrative where we pretend that once you get outside of this country that nobody else has a university, right? So the S-hole countries clearly are not educating their people. I thought it was compelling when MSNBC presented an image of a Haitian and a Ghanaian, one of whom, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Ghanaian who worked for the National Guard. He was a soldier in the National Guard, and he went into a burning building on several occasions to pull people out of it and died doing that. And another was an image of a Haitian, I believe it was a Haitian cadet graduating with a tear rolling down his cheek. And we are beginning to hear about people being deported who are contributing these kinds of things to our society. They are fighting for us, wearing the uniform in the military, fighting, dying for this country, and yet don't have full rights.
Yeah, so that's what we're definitely going to talk about here today on the show, is putting actual stories and concerns about the spending bill, but particularly about DACA, this discussion of Dreamers and immigration, right? And that's where Trump's comment began. They were actually in a meeting discussing potential agreement over passing the spending bill, which, by the way, is the job of Congress dating back to 1787. They've mostly been able to pull that off. But they were discussing this, and he said he didn't want people coming from what he called S-hole countries. And he used Norway, apparently, as an example of where people should come from, a majority white country. By the way, what'd you think of his CADA member there? Her name is escaping me right now. Who
couldn't recall?
Yeah, she couldn't recall him making the comment, and then she didn't know that Norway was a majority white country.
Yeah, so, yeah, I took issue with that. But again, you know, as somebody who came up during the Nixon administration as a kid, I'm sort of used to the I don't recall responses as responses that I'm going to hear from politicians. But I wanted to say, with respect to the Norway comment and the S-hole comment, this is also about cultural amnesia or colonial amnesia. So the United States, if you think about Haiti, the United States has had the same policy towards Haiti, has the same policy now as they've had when Haiti liberated itself. We've shunned Haiti. We had to shun Haiti then because we had slaves in the country. And the Haitian revolt was a revolt of formerly enslaved people. So there was no way that we could embrace those individuals.
And they actually used Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence.
Correct.
In their own declaration.
He was the
president of the United States at the time that they succeeded and could have recognized them.
That's correct. So that sentence that our president issued is, I think, insulting on so many levels. It is to say, one, that I have this colonial amnesia. I'm not going to remember or take responsibility for the oppression of your country. And it is also to say that I'm not responsible for, historically responsible for, the reasons why you might be an S-hole country. I'm simply going to call you an S-hole country, which is the worst kind of colonial attitude that I think you can take. But I think we're seeing a revival of colonial attitudes, generally speaking, in our president's attitude towards the UN and to so-called S-hole countries. And by the way, he presumes that people from Norway actually want to come to the United States. I'm not sure why people from Norway or any place that has a national health care system actually want to come to the United States in the first darn place.
Maybe they've never had gravy on a cheeseburger with chicken wings on top.
So I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that would be
a big attraction out here in the States.
And animal fries.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So when we come back, we're going to talk to our guests. We're going to actually hear their stories and give you a chance to put some stories to the political digital diarrhea that the corporate media has been covering. We'll be back after this short musical break.
C'est pour ma paix chanter jodi a. Moi connais au chita la voix tandem. Si problème la vie a t'apprend tes tout. Moi connais toujours un main.
Si toutefois, yon jour nous t'a séparé, à penser que m'bras l'obligé. Pour toute sa chérie, ou passez pour moi. Tout ça écrit dans le cœur, moi. Moi, pape, j'oublie ou chéri. Pour tout ça, ou passez pour moi. Malgré tout, passez qui sont côté joint. Moi, pap, j'oublie ou chéri. Pour tout ça, ou passez pour moi. Malgré tout, passez qui sont côté joint.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. And we are talking about immigration, DACA, Dreamers, and higher education. It's a big show and a lot to get to.
All right, we want to welcome into our studio three student activists at California State University East Bay from an organization called Students for Quality Education, SQE. We're welcoming Lala, who is a third year at East Bay, first-generation student and ethnic studies major. Yay. And Khalil, a third year at East Bay, physics major. Fantastic. We're going to have to talk about some physics at some point in time. Yeah. I'll try to keep up in that conversation. And Alexis, also a third-year, first-generation student, business administration with an entrepreneurship option and a real estate minor. Fantastic. We want, first of all, welcome you guys to the Project Censored Radio Show.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Lala, I kind of want to get started with you. If you would tell us a little bit about Students for Quality Education and some of the events that you guys are involved in with respect to DACA and immigration.
Students for Quality Education is a organization throughout the whole CSU system. We have student activists around California, and we basically focus on making the CSU...
California State University System.
Yes, accessible for everybody and also affordable. And the stuff that we have been doing around DACA, which kind of intertwines with our whole vision of making it accessible and affordable for everybody, is we have done banner drops. We have done a social media campaign on our Instagram. We have done just like informed people of where they could get resources before the deadline had happened of if you were eligible to reapply, where they could go do that for free or for very little money.
Thank you.
So how long has this program been running?
For Students for Quality Education, right. That's what you're asking?
Right. How long has it been in existence, are you aware?
I'm not quite sure, but for many, many years now.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like an interesting program. Is it it's all the CSUs are working together on this, and so you're like a representative of the satellite campus at California State University East Bay?
Yes, they have these programs in all of the California State Universities, and they do have an internship. So I'm a part of the internship, and we basically make a club in every campus, and that's where they come in.
Oh, so that's where Alexis and Khalil come in?
Right, yeah.
So where can people go to find out more about the work you guys are doing? Is there a website or anything like that where people can find out more?
Yeah, so Students for Quality Education, you guys are running not only – you have a huge social media presence. Maybe you could tell people about that where they can connect with you through social media.
Anywhere on social media, if you just type in SQE, you'll be able to find us. Students for Quality Education, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, and on Facebook.
Fantastic. So maybe if we get all of you guys in on this discussion, one of the things that we really want to drill down on in this program are stories that we've heard about students in particular and individuals who are facing deportation, families that have been torn apart. I noticed as I was reading the news recently that there was a recent deportation that I found particularly troubling. There was an individual who was recently deported here.
Was this someone deported from California or? Well, Nick pulls that up. I'm sort of curious, Alexis and Khalil. Either you want to tell us sort of your story of how you got involved with the program and kind of what you guys have experienced so far.
Yeah, so I actually got involved of SQE my second year of college.
One of my friends he was an intern for the program, and he told me to come on through to the program. And then once I realized what they're fighting for and who they're fighting for, then they wanted me to join the club and to join the fight as well.
By joining the fight, what are some of the things you've done in the program?
We actually protest and we speak for the rest of the students. Last year there was a tuition increase, and we actually went to the Board of Trustees meeting to protest that.
So take our listeners kind of into that. So what are those protests like that look like? Like, how do you feel? What are the reactions you get out of that? Kind of get our listeners into that protest.
Right. So the protest was very, very powerful. It got a lot of SQE members and just people, students, teachers from just the area. We actually drove down to Long Beach, it was, and we got together and we joined up to protest. We all teamed up against Common Cause.
Oh, good. So you mentioned that about educators being there, teachers there, right?
Right.
As a student, how does that make you feel? Is that important to you or not important to you? How do you feel when the teachers are on site with you in those protests?
I think when the teachers are on site, it's very powerful. It's more like teacher-student bond.
The story I was looking at was the story of Jorge Garcia, 39, a Detroit landscaper who has lived in the United States for 30 years. In fact, he came to the United States at 10 and was recently deported, leaving his wife and children, who are actually U.S. citizens. But for some reason, he didn't qualify for DACA because he was over the age limit. And just looking at stories like that, I'm wondering if there are others that you've seen throughout the CSU involving students, people that you're close to.
Yes, I actually have two uncles that will be deported this year. It sucks.
I mean, what is that like, Lala? I mean, when you're dealing with two uncles who have lived here most, if not all, of their lives and don't really know anything about where they're being deported to, have lives and careers and families. What's that discussion like with your family?
On one side, for one of my uncles, three of their oldest kids have DACA, which means they won't be able to see their parents for a really long time. They don't know when, if they'll ever be able to see them again. And the other one, their kids were born here, which makes it a lot more easier, but there is still that discussion, because a lot of them are minors, of, you know, who's going to take who in, and just that separation. It's hard for them. We do live in a very machismo, family-orientated. It's very like that, which means a lot of the guys aren't able to really express their feelings. One of my cousin's girlfriend was able to tell me that he cries at night with her, which is really hard for me to hear, just because I feel like, because we're very machismo culture, they're not able to really express themselves with other family members or really talk about what they're going through. But it's been a difficult ride. They're going to be deported in a few months, so it's just getting prepared for that day, the emotional stress that it's going to be on the family, but also just like economic-wise, who just planning for the whole thing, it's really hard. But we do have that privilege of being able to know when it's going to happen. There's families that it's just the next day and they're out of here.
Exactly, they're out of here.
Yeah.
It has always struck me that, for example, in the case of your uncles, who have been in the United States, what, how many years? We're talking about 20, 30?
Yeah, more than 20.
Okay, so like Jorge Garcia, for example, there's nobody talks about this, but there's actually an investment that this country has made in these individuals, right? So they've worked, they've paid into our social security system, mm-hmm. they've been educated. It's not just that they've given back to our society, it's that we as a society have invested in them.
Yes, all of my uncles actually had a personal business. They've paid their taxes. They've paid their dues. They've lived here all of their lives, just as anybody else has. And like I said, they've paid their way here. And yeah, we have put a lot of money back into this government, and then just to see them.
Yes. I mean, this is sort of the way I always hear the discussion framed in terms of the investment that these immigrants have put into our country. But mm-hmm. I think people fail to see the investment that the country has put into the individual. And to me, it's like, if I've invested in an individual for 30 years, I don't want them out of my country because I've made that investment in them. I want their intellectual power to stay here, and I want their labor power, their expertise to stay here. So it's like we've both, you know, both sides have contributed. Our government seems to be ignoring right now the investment that both sides have made. the investment that we have made in them as a country and that they have made in us as individuals who want to be in this country.
That makes a lot of sense because throughout the years, they have put in a lot of hard work, but that hard work also comes back to this country.
That's right.
Which is something I had never really thought about. It's kind of like a double loss for them, but also for this nation.
Mm-hmm. So any of you can answer this, Lala, Alexis, or Khalil. But Lala, your story seems in particular to match up with this. We hear this sort of narrative, especially coming from conservative media, that the immigrants who come here and their children of immigrants, they're not American, right? They're always immigrant status, even generationally down the line. Somehow that never goes away. How do you respond to something like that?
At the end of the day, we're all immigrants. We all came from a different country. We're not all from here.
Amen to that.
So, I mean, that's the only way I can think of responding.
Mm-hmm. What about yourself, Paula?
For me, it's interesting. My family's from Mexico. Just hearing that narrative from people that came to this land a lot after my people were here, it's a little bit, it used to be hurtful, but now I kind of laugh at it. But maybe that's because that's my way of coping with it. And it also doesn't affect me directly. But just that narrative, it's kind of interesting to hear go back to your or wherever you came from, but
right.
I've been here for longer than you.
Absolutely. Pre-Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, let's see what the civilization looked like then, right?
Yeah.
It also fascinates me that the news media, in particular, I want to say the quote-unquote supposedly left-leaning news media, focuses on the number 800,000 for DACA. The number is 3.6 million for Dreamers. It's 800,000 of those Dreamers who are in DACA, but we're really talking about 3.6 million people. And I've often wondered sort of what the political gain is, particularly of left-wing media, to focus on 800,000 as opposed to the 3.6 million. To me, it seems absurd to deport 800,000, but if in case that's not absurd enough for you, how about deporting 3.6 million people? Enough people to fill up a pretty good-sized city in America. Those are the real numbers that we're looking at. Any sense of why the news media plays around with these figures? Nolan, have you thought about this?
The only thing I can come up with, I'm thinking of Ann Coulter, who's known as crazy. And Coulter, she tries to use, I think, this number. She's like 30 million or some insane number is what she used. I think the big number sort of feeds into like the right-wing narrative that there's this
right, and for some reason,
immigrants coming to take over the
right, and for some reason the left-wing number is lower. So you'll get a 30 million from an Ann Coulter and an 800,000 from left-wing media, and we've got this number of 3.6 million Dreamers, in effect. And it feels to me like both sides are kind of playing political games with this group of people.
So when we come back, we are going to continue our conversation. We're going to ask about actual stories from what families are experiencing going through so we can put some stories to the political conversation, we'll call it. We'll be back after the short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and we are talking about immigration and media narratives.
So we wanted to drill down a little bit more on some of the personal stories that you guys are familiar with, maybe even stories that pertain to your own families. Lala gave us a little bit of a sense of that with her two uncles who are going to be deported and the anxiety that's happening within the family. Do either of you guys have anything to share about either students you know or things that are happening to you personally within your own families? Because we really want to, I think, as fact-based journalists, put some faces on this, some real stories, so people can understand the real pain that folks are facing.
Personally, myself, my mom is going through TPS. So she has TPS.
Can you define that for our listeners?
TPS is temporary protective. That is, yes, correct. She has been here since she's been 23 years old. She left El Salvador for one reason, because her and her family were being sought out by the government. We don't know what to do, because now that TPS has been rescinded, we've contacted a lawyer to see what we could do. So far, what they've told us is that she could potentially get path to citizenship through me. The only problem is that my family makes $22,000 for the whole year. They're charging us $10,000 to $12,000.
Wow. So almost half of total family income.
Yes.
Wow.
And you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the poverty line's at
$100,000. Right.
Just to bring that up.
Right. Just to bring that up, you're well below that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's been tough on our family. We've gone countless days thinking about what's going to happen.
Alexis, let me ask you this. Do you feel exploited by the lawyer?
In what regards?
Charging you $10,000. I mean, there's an aspect of this, too, that the news media hasn't really explored, which is the business of DACA, right? So, yeah, there are a lot of good people who are providing free public services to people to help them stay in the country, but there are a lot of people who are making money off of helping folks stay in the country.
The prison industry, for
example. Exactly, yeah.
It's
another sort of way. It's almost like they make money off of you in so many different ways,
yeah.
Right? The lawyer making money off of you is just one end among many.
Yeah.
Do you feel a little bit exploited on that end too?
A little, but at the end of the day, I'm just thinking, what can we do to keep my mom here?
Right.
That's what really matters to me. Money comes and goes to me.
Right.
You're going to get it you're going to get it now, later, or never. It doesn't really matter. My mindset is to keep my mom here.
Yes.
Especially since she's made me the person who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me be able to talk to you guys right here, right now.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I ask this is it just reminds me so much of, and Lala kind of alluded to this, it reminds me of so much of what happened to people after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which was that, so they promised that Mexican citizens who had lived in what was formerly known as Alta California or Upper Mexico, that wasn't particularly well settled, they said, look, you can defend your Spanish land grant in the courts. Now, of course, all the courts then are English. So you have to have a lawyer who can kind of translate a Spanish document from the Crown to an English-speaking American court. And oftentimes what that meant was lawyer fees upon lawyer fees upon lawyer fees, which then meant that landed Mexicans who had their ranchos and so forth and so on were basically rich or middle class or whatnot, had to then begin to sell off parts of the farm, parts of the territory that they had, to the point where a lot of families were left with nothing and then had to leave. So it just, I wonder, for example, with all the indecisiveness around DACA, how long your mother and other programs, how long your mother gets caught up in the legal system paying fees to stay in the country, and maybe gets to a point where you don't get to stay in the country, right? But you have paid all that money to do so.
Yeah. From as far as I know, the lawyer has given us a time frame of within a year,
okay.
a year and a half. Hopefully he stays true to that word. If he doesn't, then we'll figure it out at that time.
Okay.
But unfortunately, I was hit with a double whammy because my girlfriend's also in DACA too.
Oh, wow.
She's also under the poverty line as well. She's been here since she was 1 year old. So she doesn't know Mexico.
Yeah, at all.
So, Alexis, these are two individuals, your partner and your mother, who you see often and you know well. Kind of describe what's with the change of maybe like the last year or the last maybe couple months, whatever. What would you say has changed about these individuals as far as maybe the way they interact or the way they seem? Can you kind of describe that for our listeners?
They're all scared. Plain and simple, they're scared. They don't want to go back. My mom's a political refugee from El Salvador. My girlfriend just doesn't know Mexico. She didn't grow up there. They live in fear every single day. They don't know what's going to happen. Because maybe one day President Trump wants to, tired of dealing with all you Congress people, I'm just going to deport every single person right now. We don't know what's going to happen. That's why they live in fear.
Are you afraid that your mother could be facing death upon being
sent
back?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yes.
At any time when someone's a political refugee and you're sent back, you're always going to have that mindset, death.
And yet this is supposed to be a country that welcomes the political refugee.
Yeah, it is.
And that with respect to El Salvador, certainly going back to the 1980s and our engagement in El Salvador, has now a responsibility to political refugees, particularly since we helped to create the situation that produced the political refugees like your mother.
I mean, my mom's mom, actually. So my grandma, she needs medical help as well. So we're sending money from here to over there. Especially since, I mean, from what I remember, what my mom told me, she said that her brother's making $5 a day over there. And they're not even close to keeping the whole family healthy. It's a little ridiculous how we are not seeing how people are being affected. Not just here, but in the original country as well. It's a little absurd to me.
For our listeners, I'd say Nick has brought up quite a few times about the U.S. colonialism and invasion of other countries. History as a Weapon is a great website that has an interactive map where you can click on countries to see all the different invasions the U.S. has done in that country. We're not associated with that website, but I'll give it a plug. I wonder if you guys can talk about sort of we like to talk a lot on this show about solutions and how people can take action. And I'm always a big proponent of the young people are where it goes. The young people are the ones who are going to control the narrative. You know, the older generation gave us Nixon through Trump. It's the young people are going to control where we go from here. As a young person and as an activist-minded individual, you know, what recommendations do you have to our listeners? I mean, what should they be doing to help move this in a position where we don't have mothers who are in fear, or we don't have sons who are in fear their mothers are going to get killed, or our partners are going to get deported, or uncles? What would you recommend to listeners that they start doing or be aware of?
I'd say for the listeners, just simply to educate yourself about what's actually going on and what's happening, because education is power, education is key. And if you know the plans and the next moves, then it'll save you some time to build a better strategy.
Call your representatives. Let them know that this is important to you, and let them know that we need a permanent solution for many, many people that we've said we've invested in them and they've invested in us, and we need them here.
Be the change. Go out and do something. Don't just stand around and let it happen.
Yeah, it strikes me as something we've seen historically that there's been a lot of studies have come out recently. They've talked about how sort of the older generation of undocumented immigrants really kind of tried to hide in the shadows. And this younger generation is much more confrontational. They're saying, no, we need to take to the streets right now and go up against this. And regardless what happens in the end, it'll do the best results. Do you guys kind of agree with that narrative? Do you agree with this direct confrontation?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and not hiding in the shadows. It also strikes me that the movement that you guys are putting together is deeply intersectional, which is very beautiful to see for me. So it's not just about people who are going to be deported back to Mexico or El Salvador or somewhere in Central America banding together. But I'm seeing on the campus when I watch you guys do your thing, I'm seeing LGBTQ students with you. I'm seeing African-American students with you, so forth and so on. We certainly have Khalil here who's with you as well. And I love that because that's just, I think, an expression of Americans who are saying, hey, I love my DACA friend. Okay, I love people who live in my neighborhood. I love the people who I know are immigrants, and I go to their shops in my neighborhood. And I want to put my body on the line to make sure that those people don't get deported.
It's like you said, very beautiful to see. And it's also very powerful, and it's what we need. We need anybody just to stand with dreamers and undocumented people who are afraid, because we've done it, and it's powerful, and it feels good.
It does, yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, the power, I think the power of the protest movement on this is really huge, like you're talking about, that it's really intersectional. And I think, because at this point, you talk about the 3.6 million. Most people, I would say, know individuals who are undocumented, and especially have a track record like Lala was talking about, her uncles, 20 to 30 years in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're supposedly these like horrible people, what are they waiting for? Like the fourth decade to finally reveal their people?
Right.
It's really legit insanity. And so I think it's one of those things where we've lived with these individuals, so we don't really can't wrap our minds around it.
That's right. And I think that, you know, the protest angle is very important. This past week, there was an article that came out from an African-American conservative thinker by the name of Shelby Steele. Now, he's mostly focused on the protests that Colin Kaepernick started in the NFL. But the upshot of his piece was that protest is no longer effective. The protest that we had, for example, in the 60s or whatever. And obviously, Shelby I think he's misread the protest of young people and the degree to which you're using a lot of other tools in your protest that weren't used in the 60s. I think a lot of people like Shelby Steele are still thinking about that old 60s Southern Christian Leadership Conference model. But you're talking about using social media, maybe grabbing more of a national audience, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In what you do. And that's another question that I have for you, too. As student activists, I know you're connected throughout the state of California. Are you connected with students outside of California? Are you in communication with people in other states who are doing similar actions?
Personally, not. I do follow a lot of them on social media to mm-hmm. see what they are doing, what kind of ideas we can use on this side. I am following people, seeing what they do. I don't know anybody personally, but even just them doing actions across the nations, we see you over here.
Mm-hmm. I think I would love to actually facilitate something like that through this program, where we could maybe get a couple of voices from other states along with student activists in this state like you guys mm-hmm. to have a discussion on air about the different things that are happening in different states.
That would be great.
Yeah. Okay.
It'd be a great idea. If any of our listeners have any ideas or ways to contribute to that, contact us at projectcenterradio@gmail.com.
Right, and contribute to the conversation. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you in studio and sharing your stories. And I mean, the work. There's no dollar amount we can put on the work you're doing for future generations.
Right.
So I applaud all of you, and thank you very much for being on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break.
Diego,
cuando no la llamo, siempre me hace reclamo. Discutimos, peleamos, pero llego a casa en la noche, la molesto y arreglamos. Peleamos, nos arreglamos, nos mantenemos en esa, pero nos amamos. Ay, pa. Mami, peleamos, nos arreglamos, nos mantenemos en esa, pero nos amamos y ahí vamos. Qué pena me daría no tenerte en mi vida, vida mía.
No importa si estás lejos, siempre te siento presente y estoy pendiente de ti frecuentemente. Cuando estoy en la calle resolviendo mis problemas, es para nuestro futuro, yo no sé por qué me celas. No soy un santo, tampoco ando en cosas malas. Cuando no estoy contigo es porque ando con mis panas. Somos buenos opuestos y por eso no gustamos. ¿Qué mal le vamos a hacer si así nos enamoramos? Y ahí vamos.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. I thought that was pretty good, Nick. And you think that was good?
Yes, I did. I think it was very important for us to hear some of the personal stories around DACA and to put some real feeling and emotion into it.
Okay, well, Alex Archuleta is here to tell us more about how you can get in contact with the Project Censored Show and reach all of us.
I'm Alexandra Archuleta with the Media Freedom Foundation. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to www.projectcensored.org, where you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. You can also rate and like us on iTunes. If you would like to reach the show or have us discuss something on the air, please send us an email to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. That's projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Your feedback can also be directed to Twitter, to Nolan at Nolan_Higdon, or to Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks.
All right. Thank you very much, Alex. Yeah, and please do send us your feedback and like us on iTunes and all those sorts of things. That gets everybody really happy at the foundation. We've gotten a lot of positive responses about the show, and we have archives now of 7 years' worth of shows you can look at projectcensored.org. So go check us out. And by the way, just before we get to Amy, I know Amy's got the news coming up, but Nick's Flicks, Nick, people are loving Nick's Flicks.
Yes, and we have another one coming up very soon. We're looking forward to getting into our next segment of Nick's Flicks.
Right, Nick's Flicks. It's going
to
be like us.
And we really thank you guys out there in the audience for your response to that.
Nick is our Roger Ebert.
I'm growing in the role. Yeah.
All right. Amy, at the Media Freedom Foundation, we produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy is here to tell us more.
I am Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are currently working on. From Syracuse University, Jeff Simmons and his student, Haley Schechter, have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled FBI Racially Profiling Black Identity Extremists. The story covers the FBI's categorization of activists, not by their common ideologies or goals, but by race, in a report released that warned of the dangers of black identity extremists before white supremacists were scheduled to descend on Charlottesville, Virginia, last August. The full story can be found at projectcensored.org. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams and his student, Lydia Massey, from the University of Vermont, have published Social Media, Driver of Political Change or Perpetrator of Political Polarization. The article observes political discourse and change by examining the flaws of social media and how users engage with it. Not only can it drive positive change, but it can also amplify polarization and extremism, sensationalize posts that lack critical thinking and disregard opposing viewpoints. From Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student, Joanna Patricia Medina, have nominated a validated independent news story titled Media's Blind Spot for Low-Income Victims of Natural Disasters. The story focuses on the deficiency of primary sources during national disaster media coverage. While the media's job is to figure out a way to tell the stories of the people who are caught in this and why they are caught in this, the coverage of Hurricane Harvey failed to bring the crucial elements of poverty and racism into its discourse. That can be found at projectcensored.org. From the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Allison Butler and her students, Logan Dean, Catherine Lyons, and Blair Macklin have published Devastating Hurricane Season Impacts Education Across Caribbean. The article examines the efforts of the Caribbean higher educational institutions and their students to recover from the hurricanes against the backdrop of intense financial strain on national budgets. The destruction left in the wake of Hurricanes Irma and Maria closed 11 universities and displaced many students, some of whom have withdrawn, fearing that the cost will be unmanageable during rebuilding. That is available at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, also from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Allison Butler and her students, Kaylee Armstrong, Jessica Lavelle, and Jenna Mola, have published School Desegregation Victory in Cleveland, Mississippi. The story covers the historic integration of two public high schools in Cleveland, Mississippi, 63 years after the Supreme Court case Brown versus Board of Education, due to the dwindling court oversight and enforcement since the landmark decision. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/radio. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Amy. You know what it was occurring to me, Nick, when we were talking, we had our guests in here earlier. It's just off the top of my head, but we were talking about that piece from the conservative who said that protests,
Shelby Steele.
Right, that yes. Protest movements don't work anymore. What do you say to the men who've been exposed by the Me Too campaign or the NFL that's lost money from the Kaepernick protests?
Right. Clearly protests work, yeah.
Like clearly, I think those individuals would say protest works, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
That was kind of laughable.
Yeah, his thing was specifically focused on the quote-unquote anthem protests, which are not actually anthem protests at all, as we know, and whether those have been effective or not. Frankly, if you judge effectiveness by the fact that viewership in the NFL has been down, then I would say that those protests have been effective. Whether they've actually resulted in sweeping change, that's a whole other issue. I know that some teams have committed to money, and the NFL has committed to money in communities. And I think that the issue has gotten out there, whether or not people want to pay attention or not. The issue, those players have gotten that out.
I agree. That's one of the things, that, especially in the instantaneous communication culture we live in, that everyone wants results right away.
That's right.
These social movements and changes have always taken long time, decades to achieve. So it's in the early awareness stages.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Before we go to Nick, what's the next Nick's Flicks going to be about?
The next Nick's Flicks, which we're going to do in February, is going to be the 1933 film Gabriel Over the White House, starring the great Walter Huston. So everybody get ready for that in February. Watch that. That is a film about how an American president turns the entire government into a single-party dictatorship.
And of course, yeah, if you watch the film, we will talk about it here on the radio. We'll analyze it, and we make comparisons to the present, which is all too easy to do with some of these films.
Shockingly easy to do, yes.
But really, really useful as well. All right. Well, I want to thank all of our guests today. I want to thank all of our listeners. I want to send our love to people out there from the California mudslide and others who are affected by climate change. It's been a rough winter. East Coast has been slammed and pounded as well. And so send our love out to those people.
And to the people in Puerto Rico who are still struggling without power, this long without power.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our engineer is Mitch Scorza. He's also our director. Mitch is phenomenal. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States of America. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org. where you can find the archives of all of our radio shows for the past 7 years, as well as over 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy.